Launched in 2020 as a resource for teachers navigating the COVID-19 pandemic, Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is a podcast about all things early childhood teaching. I'm Dr. Christine Lippard, and each episode I interview researchers, classroom teachers, or other early childhood practitioners on a specific early childhood education topic. Intended to provide research background, practical ideas, and cheering on from a distance, Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is the long-distance mentoring your teacher prep faculty wish they could provide. Let me start by apologizing for ghosting the podcast. It's been a minute. I spent most of the summer maybe doing what is beginning to sound cliche, but is so important. I spent most of the summer prioritizing my mental health and getting recharged and recovering from last school year and taking care of my family, and we moved. I am excited to be back. The format of the podcast is going to change a little going forward. It's been super fun to connect with people and hear about their expertise and their stories and their classroom experiences. And so for myself as well as listeners, I want to keep that going, but I also have to fit it in the context of all of the other things I'm responsible for. So it'll be a monthly podcast, and I will still be interviewing, other than this episode, experts in the field. Sometimes that will include practitioners, but sometimes it won't. I have really struggled with the idea of asking teachers and practitioners for their time outside of work that I am not able to compensate them for, often seeking out those practitioners who are already putting extra time and effort into doing what they're doing. And so the podcast is really meant to support and encourage teachers and not to add burden. And so you will actually hear from less classroom teachers and practitioners over this next year, unless we make some changes and develop the capacity to compensate folks, because we don't want to ask for more time, more volunteer time, as if early educators don't already give enough volunteer time. So that said, my heart is always in the classroom, and we will talk about research and the evidence base that informs evidence-based practice, but we will not leave it there. We will take it real world. And I think as I continue to learn and grow as a professional, and then also personally living with young children, I understand things differently all the time. Try to continue to grow in my perspective. And so we want to make sure that we are bringing that realistic perspective. The idea that I talk about all the time with my students and on the podcast, that relationships are key, is really important to talk about. Relationships are key. Positive relationships are a priority in the classroom. But even thinking about yesterday, seeing an Instagram post that said, you can keep telling me that relationships with kids are the top priority, but if you keep putting 35 kids in my class at a time, then your actions don't match your words. And so want to talk about evidence-based practice and what evidence is telling us, or what research is telling us is good for kids, but also want to talk about the reality that we live in. And I remember, even as a preschool teacher with just 16 in my class, because part of my job being coaching college students who were there as well, that there were days that I would have to think about, did I even interact with that child? And that's, you know, and that's an okay place to be, because then you go back the next day and you make sure that you find that one and have some time with them. But recognizing the reality that teachers are operating in. And so along with that reality and sort of reflecting back on the last year of the podcast, I want to acknowledge that the gaping hole in our lineup last season was an episode dedicated to addressing topics of equity and inclusion. And what that looked like in the classroom and what folks were experiencing, teachers and children. And so I want to acknowledge that and apologize for not doing the work to make that happen. And I don't want to just give excuses, but maybe that's what this will be. Anyway, there's a challenge in reaching out to researchers who are doing a lot of diversity, equity, and inclusion work that often those are folks who are called on to speak to that work frequently and in a variety of contexts. And those are often scholars of color or scholars who are BIPOC. And so, again, just wanting to be very careful of not overburdening folks, teachers, researchers, families, in trying to make this content available. And so I'm continuing to think about and to explore opportunities and options to bring a more diverse perspective to what we're talking about and to address topics related to equity and inclusion. The other challenge there, I think, is recognizing that a lot of the practitioners who are making a really concerted effort to address anti-bias in their classrooms or to address inclusion and equity by sort of challenging the status quo and the systems as they exist may also be teachers that are in a vulnerable position already. And so asking them to speak about what they're working on in their classrooms is inviting criticism or attention that they may not desire or that may not be in their best interest in this stage in their career. So I share those thoughts not to make an excuse for not addressing equity and inclusion more directly. We try to talk about it with every topic, but obviously could also use just some specific attention all on its own. But to let you know that it is not forgotten, that it is on my mind, and there have been behind the scenes efforts. But as you can imagine, last year and continuing, folks that do that kind of do that, their primary focus of their work is around equity and inclusion, were asked to do a lot of extra work to educate the rest of us while also navigating a pandemic school year themselves. So that said, that is a priority for this upcoming year, not just in all of our topics to think about how does it relate to inclusion of all children and educators, but also to call out some specific opportunities to talk about and highlight aspects of equity and inclusion. Okay, so the topic that I really want to dive into with this episode is this idea of learning loss. And most episodes will involve hearing from other people, but this might just be a lot of me talking. But I want to acknowledge that this narrative of learning loss, I see danger in two ways. And so I want us to be aware of it. And I know that, that part of dealing with the reality of where teachers are going to be this fall is that if you are listening, there's a chance that you just had a whole PD about learning loss and how you're going to catch up. And I'm sorry. Or maybe it was really great and you had an administrator that was like, just stop listening to that and don't read Twitter and it'll be fine. But you know, this idea of learning loss is based on benchmarks and milestones and timing of curriculum and skills and testing that, well, I was going to say we all, but the reality is if you're listening to this, it was probably not you. It certainly wasn't me. But the educators or people who make decisions for educators have imposed on children. So it's not like they exist in the natural world, and if children don't know the whole alphabet by week 17 of kindergarten, then, the earthquakes will come and the volcanoes will erupt. Like, they're not written into the natural world. They're actually based on observations of real children. And as we observed over so long, we, using the collective we of people who have been involved with early childhood over the past, you know, hundreds of years. But as researchers and educators have observed children over time, we have both systematically and informally gotten a sense of when skills develop and what is the typical pacing of skill development. And so that is where the idea of milestones comes from originally. Now, depending on what you're looking at, you've either been provided with the average, like the average child learns to read at this age, or you've been provided with a range, or you've been given a 90% of children learn to read by this age, just using reading as an example. But it's really important to know that, right? Because if we're given the average age, then it's actually going to be equally typical for children to learn before and after that. So trying to get our whole class to be able to do a skill when it emerges on average or when it's mastered on average, like, that doesn't make mathematical sense. That's not how averages work, right? If it's that we see 90% of kids master something by a given age, then that's a more useful target that we would expect our class to be on track with. But remember that all of those are based on observations of a certain set of kids under a certain set of contexts. And I can guarantee you that the context was not the COVID-19 pandemic and at-home learning. If you think back to the previous pandemic that we've often referenced during this one, the influenza pandemic of 1918, think about how different school would have looked and how distance learning would not have been a part of it at all. And early childhood education would have been really, really young and not such a commonplace experience. So first off, we have to let go of this idea that milestones and benchmarks are fixed and finite and exist as a part of reality that wasn't created. They're part of our created reality in academics. So that said, when children have different experiences, we would expect those milestones to shift. A great example of this from early childhood is the extremely successful public health campaign, Back to Sleep. And many of the norms and milestones based on observations from when we recommended putting infants to sleep on their back, carried over past when we learned that that was not the safest option for them and started asserting the importance of putting children on their backs to sleep. So if you look at the writings of Janet Gonzalez-Mina and others, you will see an explanation that when children started being put on their backs to sleep, they naturally were spending less time lifting their heads up from the tummy position because they woke up on their backs. And so the timing of milestones like lifting your head and rolling over and those sorts of things, well, they should have shifted, but they didn't shift. We kept them and then we said, okay, now we have all these kids who aren't hitting their milestones on time. Well, we know that development is driven by opportunity, motivation, and maturation. And so those kiddos just had less opportunity, but that doesn't mean that it's a problem. Now, we could have a whole other episode on tummy time and sort of forcing that opportunity on children, but we're not going to get into that today. But my point is, it's not that kids suddenly were failing to thrive. It's that something in the environment changed. And so one way to respond would be to say, oh, okay, now kids are going to roll over a little later. That's not what has happened, but it's the developmental approach that in many ways I would advocate for. And so similarly, if we're used to preschoolers coming in with certain skills or ending with certain skills, or kindergartners or first graders or seventh graders or high schoolers or college students, and this is what I'll be reminding my colleagues of in the coming weeks, come in with certain skills, we all need to adjust that is not where they're going to come in this time. Some will. Some will come in ahead, right? Some were at home with their retired teacher grandmas and grandpas or aunts and uncles or parents, or got to do a pod school with a private nanny or those sorts of things. And they're going to come in and you're going to think, oh, this is not what I was expecting. Those skills are really advanced. Others are going to come in and they're not going to have skills that you expected. Not just reading, writing, counting skills, but I think about, I have a 15-month-old, and when COVID hit its lowest point in our community, we went back to our church and we put him in the nursery. And I said to the gals working, I said, oh my gosh, you have this whole cohort of babies that are terrified of strangers because they haven't been out in the world. They were born during the pandemic. They can't wear masks. And so many of them have been kept at home. Now, on a personal note, the Delta variant is running rampant. And so we will not be back in that context in case you want to call me out for not being COVID safe. Believe me, we have taken lots of precautions and we are battening the hatches back down. But all that to say, we're going to see some of these cohort effects, right? Of like development was just different. All of a sudden you have a whole class of kindergartners who didn't ride around the grocery store with their parents because they were being kept home because of COVID or whatever. They didn't go to sports camp. They didn't have some of these same experiences. And so all of that is coming from that deficit perspective, right? I hear it myself. I've already talked about just the deficit perspective. These kids are going to come in looking different. But that's the way to think about it, is these kids are going to come in looking different. So think about all of the skills they might have. I remember early in the, not early, but about wherever we are in the pandemic, I remember seeing research come out that some of the kids who were faring the best were those middle child, my brain knew that was wrong. Middle childhood boys who had played a lot of video games prior to the pandemic, because the way they had already connected with their friends prior to the pandemic was still accessible to them. So I immediately called my sister when I saw that and I was like, okay, I know that you've really struggled with like screen time and how much to allow and whatever. I said, but look, like it turned out that in this context, that was actually a strength. You just never know, right? I'm not advocating for that. I'm just saying. Sometimes it happens. So these are going to be children who possibly were in classes with smaller sizes if they were in a pod school, or if they were still in childcare when other kids weren't. Or they're going to be kids who stayed at home and had more time with siblings or family members or whoever. Or they're going to be kids who developed different sets of independent skills because they were lightly supervised while their parents were also having to work, or whoever was taking care of them, an older sibling was home with them trying to do online school. So let's think about different skills. Okay, so all of this sounds great, right? Like you're on board, like milestones are made up. That's not true. They're not totally made up. They're based on observation, but they're based on observation of a certain set of children in a certain context, right? So they do not like exist outside of our academic reality, which is why we also see differences by culture and internationally and those sorts of things. Okay, so we've accepted that premise. That's great. If your administrator accepts that premise, even better, bonus. If not, if you have to live in the reality of, that's great. And let me just say one more thing about the idea of learning loss. Like, if we're talking about kids had skills or knowledge, or we thought they did, and then those went away, and we're thinking, then maybe learning loss is the right term. I will refer you to Mr. Chazz, MRJAZZ, on Instagram. And he uses the comparison of learning to ride a bike. So if you learn to ride a bike, and then you live like where I live, where it's really cold, and you put your bike away for the winter, there's not learning loss of how to ride a bike, but that first day out in the spring, you're a little rusty. So there may be some of that, right? And you have that every year where you're kind of priming the pump and getting everybody back into things and helping them remember things that they learned. True learning loss, like they demonstrated knowledge on a test and now they can't, was never really learned. It didn't sink into that long-term memory. It wasn't applicable. It wasn't used. It wasn't meaningful. And so that's a whole other. Okay. But let's say you just left the PD where we were talking about learning loss, and now you have to go to your team planning to strategize how you're going to address, quote unquote, learning loss. Gosh, we need a different word for that. If somebody is hearing a better, different word, please, please drop me a note on the Instagram or the Twitter and let me know what better term we're all going to use. So we're going to leave that deficit perspective. This is what these kids missed. We're going to think about, okay, but they had some experiences and they come in with some strengths that are different. What are we going to do? So I want to use an analogy because I really think in analogies. And spoiler alert, this analogy falls apart at the end, but hang with me. So I want you to think about a sponge. Children are way more complex than a sponge, but let's just start with a sponge. So I want you to think about when you pour water into a sponge, when you first start to pour water in, what happens? It soaks it up, right? But then very quickly, what starts to happen? The water just runs right through the sponge. This is how I like to think of cognitive capacity. People can only take in so much information at any given time. I talk about this all the time with other faculty. This idea that if you are quote unquote covering content, you should just have the picture in your head of pouring water through the sponge. Like students can only absorb so much. The same is true of children. They can only absorb so much. So if you're looking at the curriculum of what you think was missed from last year and all you're supposed to do this year, and you think, okay, we're just gonna have to do it on like a little faster speed. Like you could set this podcast to be on like 1.25 speed, which I think I already talk fast, so I don't recommend it. But you know, like you got stuff to do. So you're just gonna put your year on like 1.25 speed and you're gonna try to get 6 math lessons or 6 literacy lessons in every 5 days. Like just go ahead and get out a sponge for me and pour some water through it. And then think about all the effort you spent pouring after the water just started coming out of the sponge. That is not how the brain works. Like you can't just keep pouring more in. There are things you can do to make things more meaningful so they stick better, especially any kind of active learning. So where children or folks are getting the chance to use what they know and to put it into practice, to relate it to their lives, to do it with something that's meaningful to them, they're going to learn it better. That doesn't mean they can learn more, but making it meaningful is going to make it stick better. Okay, so just trying to do more faster isn't going to get us there because it's going to pour out the sponge. Here's where kids are more complex. Have you ever left a sponge out like in the sun or on the edge of the sink and it gets really dry, like crunchy dry? Not like fresh out of the package where it's a little damp and it kind of weirds you out, but like crunchy dry. What happens when you first pour water over it? It runs right off, right? Like it doesn't even absorb at first. It has to kind of like let a little in and then a little more in. And then finally the whole thing is damp and then it can absorb some more and then it starts pouring out the bottom. Sponges are really more complex than I thought about until I started using this analogy. Here's what I want you to think about with kids. Kids who are coming in stressed and anxious because they're just coming back to school and they've been gone for a while, or because they've been warned about learning loss and that they have to catch up, or because they lost a family member to COVID-19, or because their parents are still out of a job, or because they are in a new environment, or just because they're an anxious kiddo, or all of the other things that made children come into the classroom sort of closed up and shut down, totally apart from the pandemic, or when we think about, as I was talking about at the beginning, they've had experiences where some part of who they are or who their family is has been questioned and they have received adverse feedback about characteristics of themselves, such as their home language or culture or race or other aspects of their appearance or their ability or disability or family structure. Those kiddos come in and they're like that dried out, crunchy sponge. And if we start pouring spelling tests and counting on those dried out sponges, it's just gonna run off. And so what actually starts to soften up and get those sponges ready to learn are those positive relationships. Now you're like, hold on a second. You just talked about how I can't do that with 35 kids in my class. I know. I wish I could be your administrator. I wish I could fully fund school so that you could have the right. That you would have an amount of kids and a mix of kids and the support you needed to have relationships with all of them. But at least know this so that when you're trusting your gut and spending your time building positive relationships, you don't feel guilty because you're not plowing through the curriculum. Things that will help children be ready to learn This is like back to the basics. I know you know this, but let me just affirm it for you, because I'm so afraid that other folks are going to tell you that what really matters is that you get those kids caught up on sight words. And can I just tell you, like, I'm almost 40 years old. I'm an associate professor. I have my dream job. And I am still bad at spelling some of the sight words. But I remember to my core the time my first grade teacher took to demonstrate relationship and care. I have no idea what the principal was saying to her. We actually had a really great elementary principal who then retired and volunteered in teachers' classrooms. So I'm sure he was very supportive, I hope. Sorry, I lost track because I got really caught up in nostalgic memories of first grade. I won't tell you my memories of kindergarten because I had a really mean teacher who gave me an F on a paper. Who gives Fs in kindergarten? If you're giving Fs in kindergarten, stop. That's it. That's the tweet. Stop. Okay. So when you have children who are coming in and those other factors are going on, or they just don't know you and how your classroom works. Like, they're excited about school. They feel good. They're well supported. They have all of their needs met. They have all their school supplies. Everything else is peachy keen. And they come in. They still don't have a relationship with you unless you're looping. And I've heard that that's very popular this year. So that's exciting. And your routines. And so things that help bring anxiety down, and anxiety is the enemy of learning. Backing up for a second, anxiety is the enemy of learning. Think about, anxiety shuts down motivation. It might limit opportunities because kids aren't actually accessing them because they're anxious or afraid. And it, in really extreme cases, can shut down maturation or slow down maturation. So anxiety is the enemy of learning. And so when we think about that, then what we know is that having really predictable routines, especially at the beginning, and we're about to do this to our house, like, because there are some changes coming up, we're going to sit down this weekend and we're going to write out our routines and tighten them back up and get everybody so that beginning and end of the day, it feels really secure and tight. So routines, and you can let up on those later, but back to your basics with good, clear routines and communicating that information in multiple and developmentally appropriate ways. So yes, you're going to communicate it orally. You might make up a song or a chant about it. You're also going to communicate it visually. You're also going to make sure that it physically makes sense. If your morning routine is that children put their stuff away, wash their hands, and then mark their lunch choice, oh, for the love of Pete, please set your room up so that they actually physically move in that order to the extent that you are capable. Okay, so good developmentally appropriate routines and expectations. Now, I'm not saying start day one with your, like, 14 list of rules. First off, if you have 14 rules and you're listening to this podcast, you're either listening to it because you're interested in a different age or you need to decrease your rules. But what are they? What has to happen, you know, that first week to help everybody start to settle in? So when kids know what to expect, and I want to come back to that in just a second, but when kids know what to expect, that's going to reduce anxiety. When they know what's expected of them, that's going to reduce anxiety. When those are developmentally appropriate expectations of all the kids, not the average, not the kid that would sit through a 45-minute group time, but all the kids, you might have modifications for some. That's appropriate. That's going to reduce anxiety. Then, when those kids have a positive relationship with you. And that doesn't mean you have to be their buddy. And that doesn't mean when they walk in on day one, you joke around and you don't have rules. But it means they know that you are genuinely interested in them. I want you to think about probably your high school, maybe your middle school. If there was a teacher that you can think about that everybody seemed to love and be a little afraid of. We had an English teacher at my high school. I was fortunate enough to have her for 3 years. I joke that I wrote my PhD based on what I learned in her high school English class because I never took another writing class again, which maybe was a mistake. But anyway, she was known for being tough and everybody was a little intimidated about having her, and the kids who loved school and the kids who hated school and everybody in between, was a little intimidated by her, but also felt supported and cared for by her. So it's not that you can't have expectations, but that you provide the support to meet those expectations and that you show, like, interest in children. So I know you don't want to hear another story about Minecraft. I know you don't care that Daisy Duck is my daughter's best friend and she thinks Daisy's coming to visit so soon. I know that it's a little overwhelming when one person shares a story about their pet this summer and then everybody needs to share a pet story. But that feeling of being known, and then as the school year goes on, you're going to build on known and trusted, is really crucial. And so I said I want to come back to that idea of not knowing expectations. Remember that you, even with older kids this year, because the pandemic has increased, if possible, the variability and experiences children have in early childhood care and education situations, this may be their very first time in a school setting. And some of the things that seem so obvious to you, like putting your stuff in a cubby or keeping your shoes on when you're inside or asking before you go to the bathroom or lining up or any of these things, or that we don't ask for a snack whenever we want, like that we eat at set times. All of these things are different. And so get ahead of that by being clear about the expectations. But then also when children struggle with those expectations, remember that that is part of the learning process. Okay, I feel like I'm rambling on a soapbox here. All of this started by saying learning loss is made up. It is arbitrary. It is deficit perspective. And we got to let it go. Developmentally appropriate practice, which is the standard set forth by the National Association for the Education of Young Children, which covers children birth through third grade, the organization for early childhood, can be summed up as meeting children where they are and helping them take the next steps. That is all you can do. You can't meet children where they aren't. They're not there. So if you're ready to teach how to use scissors to cut out shapes and glue them together to practice a skill, and this kiddo's never held scissors, you have to back up and do some scissor practice. Because you can't meet them where they aren't. They're not there. So we're going to let go of that idea of learning loss. We're going to meet kids where they are. We're going to remember that anxiety is the enemy of learning. Some of you need your administrators to hear that. That anxiety is also the enemy of good teaching. That if you can't be in the moment with your kids and responsive to them because you were so anxious about, oh my gosh, we have got to get ready for the test in 2 weeks, like, then you're not doing your best either. I understand that. I want to recognize that. I want to own that. I wish I could change that for you. Maybe this will give you some tools to talk about that with your leadership. So we're going to recognize that anxiety is the enemy of learning. And we're going to think about that sponge, that we've got to get it good and soft and ready to take in information before learning is going to happen. So this isn't just based on Christine Feels Like. Some of it's based on Christine Feels Like. But there's actually a large body of research to support this. And so just one paper that my colleagues Ji Young Choi and Melissa Walter and I have, that I could give the reference for, but I can't remember off the top of my head. I need to look up. Looked at data sets from Head Start classrooms over a number of years, and we broke them into profiles of classrooms to look at if, you know, time spent on child-directed activities. So think about your play and your centers, or even just child-led activities within your content areas. That's doable. Inquiry-based science can be very child-led versus teacher-led activities. Like, was there a detriment to learning? And so there's mixed research out on this, and it depends on how people look at it. So I'm not saying this is the end-all, be-all. We continue to look at this. But our study of these Head Start classrooms over, like, a decade suggests that classrooms that were really marked by child-led time were not significantly different in math or reading indicators of learning and showed greater receptive vocabulary. In other words, it was not detrimental to let the kids direct how they were learning and playing. Those go together, hand in hand. Children in early childhood learn through play. It was not detrimental, and there was benefit for their language development. So there is evidence to support this, that children learn through play and that children learn through relationship, and that those are not processes we can speed up. My greatest fear with the learning loss narrative, well, actually, my greatest fear is that teachers will be so frustrated they'll leave the workforce in an even greater wave than we've already seen. My other greatest fear is that the pressure coming from the idea of catching up learning loss will drive teachers into a teacher-directed space, because that way they control the pace of perceived learning, not of learning, but of perceived learning, of covering content, so that they can get as much done as they're supposed to quote-unquote catch up. And we know from research that that is not how young children learn. Okay. This feels like a very self-indulgent soapbox episode. I promise the next time you hear from me, I will have a guest. But this is work that I have done and that is close to my heart. And so as we think about this idea of learning loss and about going into the fall, I would say even go back and listen to the first episode from last season where we really talk about relationship, because we know that... the brain is a social organ, and it learns in the context of relationship and connection and when interactions and content are meaningful to us. And so I encourage you to prioritize relationship. So much more that could be said, and I know that it's so hard when there's 1,000 things to do. But I want you to think back to your earliest memories of school and what they are, positive or negative, and let that just remind you of what it's like to be just really a person who's very young in life and has very limited experience, who is in a big, new, exciting setting, and what either you experienced that helped you feel secure and ready to learn, or what you didn't experience and needed. Teachers, I don't know if you're where I am. This has actually been really helpful in getting me excited for the fall, but otherwise, I am not coming back over the burnout or refreshed in the ways that I had hoped. And so I go in already a little bit like, oh man, here we go again. And now there's new variants of COVID, and it's still not going to be the back to normal year that we all want. And that we are being told by administrators and lawmakers that we are going to have come what may. But I want to encourage you that your classroom is your classroom, and the tone and the feel and the emotional experience in your classroom is yours to set and to determine. And I want to also encourage you that even though we hear all this rhetoric about being superheroes, you don't have to be a superhero. You're a person. And you're a person who needs to have boundaries and take care of themselves. Okay, now I'm just getting preachy, and all of this is really hard to do together, and I'm going to fail at it because today was supposed to be my, like, last me day of the summer, and instead I'm doing a podcast. But this is part of it. This is nourishing. This is life-giving for me, and so hopefully you can find parts of your work that are life-giving for you as well. We believe in you. We are here for you. We are cheering you on from a distance. We would love to hear from you about topics of interest to you, how the school year is going, how your summer is going, since we just like checked out on you, on Instagram, the tiny chairs, all one word, and the tiny chairs. There we go. So on Twitter and Instagram at the tiny chairs, would love to hear from you. Hope that your school year is off to a wonderful start. Look forward to being back monthly and hanging out with some of my favorite research pals, learning some new things, and hopefully helping explore the evidence behind those quote-unquote evidence-based practices that you are always told that you need to use. So, cheers to a wonderful 2021-22 school year. Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is recorded, edited, and produced by Christine Lippard, music by Jason Lippard. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at The Tiny Chairs.